Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up on the program, part two of our series on the holders of the keys to St. Peter's Basilica. They're known as the San Pietrini, the caretakers of one of Christianity's holiest shrines. And a cyber guide to St. Peter's. A website highlights the tombs, monuments, decorations, and history of St. Peter's Basilica so everyone can have a chance to see its treasures. Visitors to the Vatican Necropolis to describe their experience and the tour they've taken. The idea of conducting a simple survey like that amongst visitors is just one of the initiatives taken by the general manager of the Fabrica, or the Fabrique of St. Peter's Basilica, to improve the quality of tours to the shrine and to the ancient necropolis beneath it. Well, in this, part two of a four-part series of conversations with Cristina Carlostella, general manager of the office that takes care of the maintenance and the tours of the Basilica, we focus on efforts to make the Vatican experience an unforgettable and enriching one for all.
With the Vatican Necropolis, for example, I wanted to meet the guides, because as you know, the Vatican Necropolis, you can only go and visit the Vatican Necropolis through guided visits.
And a very limited number of people are allowed to go in at one time.
Exactly. We just allow groups of about 10 to 15 at a time. Reason being, of course, is for preservation. And also because we know very much that during the summer months, because of the hot temperatures here in Rome, if you go in underground spaces, of course, with like just any other archaeological excavations, you might feel a little bit of difference between the temperature and the humidity level. And so we did have some complaints with some visitors that they felt there wasn't enough air, they couldn't breathe right or whatever. So we want to be sure that these visits are as pleasant as possible. But going back to what I wanted to say is that I wanted to meet with the guides at least twice a year, because we want them to not only explain the importance of the archaeological aspects or the archaeological history of the environment, but also in a very discreet way, make them understand that this is a very, very special place, because it's not only a Roman burial area, but there are Christian burials, and this is all leading to the most sacred perno, the most sacred point of the entire site, which is, again, the tomb of Peter. So we are working as much as we can to relay this message of the spirituality and just to make people conscious. And this leads me to another initiative that I've made. This is still in 2004, as soon as I came over. I wanted to run a survey of the visitors in the Vatican Necropolis. I think this is probably one of the very few times that here in the Vatican they've done that. I have to say that because I was congratulated by the director of the Vatican Museums, because I don't think they've done this. I wanted to make a survey of what people got out of their visit in the Vatican Necropolis to see if we could improve it and what they perceived. And also to get an idea on our end of what kind of public we had in our hands. And one of the results of that survey really surprised us. For example, a very, very slight minority of these visitors actually prepare themselves before they come. Basically, a very limited percentage read something about the Vatican Necropolis before they came. So, you know, this is useful for us because it makes us understand, especially for the guides that lead these people down to the Vatican Acropolis, the kind of, you know, information level or cultural level of these visitors. And one of the other results was, again, this environmental kind of changes that they perceived as they were going underground. Again, this is not, you know, it is something that usually accompanies a visit of an archaeological site, an underground archaeological site. You do feel a difference in temperature and humidity. So what I wanted to do was, this is another thing that I really insisted upon, was to establish a monitoring system 24 hours a day down in the Vatican Acropolis for temperature and humidity control. That system had already been experimented, but I found out in 2005 to 2006 that it could have been further improved, and so we have placed some humidifiers within that area so that the humidity level is high enough to maintain the preservation conditions that we need, but at the same time does not create disagio.
Okay.
Discomfort.
Discomfort to the visitors.
Right. What sort of relationship do you have or don't you have with the Vatican Museums? I mean, you sound like you share so many interests, expertise, and problems that you would have some sort of interaction with them.
No, I'm afraid we're very good neighbors. As you know, the Vatican, here in the Vatican City-State, which is a very small state, it's a very small territory, we're all very good neighbors, but we do have different administrations, so we are not really connected to the Vatican Museum. The Vatican Museums are under the Governatorato, whereas the Fabbrica di San Pietro has its own autonomous administration.
What happens then if a mosaic or a painting or a piece of marble inside the basilica needs restoration?
It's up to the Fabbrica, basically. It's up to the Fabbrica.
You don't go to the restoration labs at the museums?
No, we don't. We do appeal to them if they have some expertise and they're ready to give us a hand in consultation. But there are areas of the basilica that are shared in terms of maintenance and restoration. Other areas are completely given over to the Fabbrica. So there are, for example, areas around the narthex or, for example, in the maintenance level of the basilica where we need work power from the Governatorato. But otherwise, it's up to us. It's up to us to actually upkeep it and to solve the problems in restoration. For example, the mosaic restorations of the pendentives over the transept is being done. That whole restoration project is being carried out by our own mosaic
laboratory,
yes.
And for the marble flooring and all that sort of thing and paintings and marble work, woodwork, whatever, would you have to go then outside if the museum is too full up with other projects that it can't cope with external projects? What do you do then?
Well, in the past, you did have other, you know, companies or, you know, coming in, people from outside coming in and taking care of these problems. But since Cardinal Marchisano's period, when he was here as Archpriest of the Basilica, he initiated, I think very wisely, a different policy. We do have workers who are the San Pietrini, who are all also very specialized in certain areas. So we found that it was cheaper for us, more economical, for us to use their talents, to use the talents needs of our own Sampietrini. And so we do have teams, for example, for electricians. We have a special laboratory for marble. We have a carpentry activity. We have a group that are electricians. So we use our own work power, our interior work power, to solve these emergencies or these problems. And again, this, on an economic level, an administrative level, this is really something that has brought a lot of fruit, a lot of productive results.
You are in charge, I would imagine, of the exposition space of the Carlo Magno, the wing on the side of St. Peter's, is that right?
Braccio Carlo Magno is actually an area that is being managed under the auspices of the Governatorato and the Vatican Museums. We just rented that space. We actually rented the space for the Pietro Segni exhibit on the Basilica, but it is really run, it is a space that is run between the Governatorato, but an area of that space is also used and managed by the Pontificio Consiglio delle Comunicazioni Sociali, of social communications, because they have, they use that space for some of the journalists who actually have a live broadcasting of some of the ceremonies in St. Peter's Square. But we did use it once, and now we might have further developments of how the Fabrique can cooperate or collaborate in the future for that particular wing, but it is not under our own direct management. Unfortunately, this is something that is, let us say, a setback in our work. We don't have a lot of spaces. We, as you see, the headquarters of the Fabrique of St. Peter is actually this bottom floor of the Palazzo della Canonica building. That is the floor underneath the sacristy of St. Peter's. And this is where our offices are, but we don't really have a nice auditorium where we could actually have conferences or conventions. We don't have a real museum space or exhibit space, so we have to sort of appeal to other environments here in the Vatican Museum that has quite a number of auditoriums, or Sala Paolo VI, Sala Nervi, if we want to have a major event, or Braccio Carlo Magno, which we have to rent from the Governatorato. So unfortunately, we don't really have a lot of spaces, and that is really a setback.
Well, setback or not, the Sampietrini workmen of St. Peter's Basilica certainly have their hands full caring for perhaps the largest Christian church ever built, covering an area of 2.3 hectares and offering a capacity for more than 60,000 people. Well, thanks then to Cristina Carlo Stella, General Manager of the Fabrica of St. Peter's. That's the Vatican office responsible for the maintenance and care of the Basilica and its foundations. Millions have trod down its nave, and countless have stared into the dizzying heights of its dome. But how many have actually studied St. Peter's Basilica, or tried to comprehend this elaborate monument as an achievement that transcends all earthly bounds?
I was actually in the seminary for 4 years, and then after that I spent 2 years working in the missions. That also influenced my decision to do this work, because being in the seminary and in the missions, I felt that I got so much from the church that I needed to give something back. I needed an apostolate, a work for the church.
Later becoming a web and computer expert in the business industry, Alan Howard felt driven by that desire to work for the church and put his personal expertise and his own personal passion for St. Peter's Basilica to the task.
Like many people, I toured St. Peter's Basilica probably 15 to 20 years ago now, and realized I was missing so much because there's so much there. And over the years, I kept coming back to St. Peter's and fell in love with it. And through different guides that I went to the Basilica with, it started to unfold for me, to open up, and I started to get more of the meaning, the significance, the beauty of St. Peter's. And through falling in love with St. Peter's, I decided to go even further and study it. And so I started collecting books and sources, and finding that there weren't a lot of good online sources for St. Peter's, I eventually decided to create a website myself.
After more than 3 years of hard work, Howard created the site www.stpetersbasilica.org, often consulting with Vatican offices and experts to fine-tune details. He's careful to say the nonprofit site is not officially endorsed by the Vatican, but he hopes his chosen apostolate will bring people closer to the faith while piquing their curiosity about one of Christianity's most hallowed shrines.
So many people go through the Basilica now, thousands, even daily, and they're really missing the true meaning of the Basilica, which is the spiritual. It's all there to bring people closer to God. And unfortunately, many people are just going through it and looking at it as a museum, which you can do because the Basilica is so beautiful and the works of art are so precious there. But to go deeper is to find the true meaning, the spiritual significance. The church has always done this in many ways, through music, through art, through all that is good, to kind of bring us into the beauty of the Catholic Church and teach us the significance. I like to kind of close my tours when I give them of St. Peter's Basilica and show them the fantastic dome there of Michelangelo. And look up at those words, tu es Petrus, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And I tell people, all of this is our answer to those words of Jesus to Peter. And then I tell them, what's going to be our individual response to the words of Jesus?
Howard's own response was to compile hundreds of pages of floor plans, photographs, and facts about the Basilica, citing authoritative texts and Catholic journals.
One thing that many people like to do is go to a floor plan map of the Basilica and just kind of click on the different altars and monuments and just kind of randomly look around the Basilica. They'll also find a map of the grottos and see where John Paul II is buried. They'll be able to go to a map of the square and identify all the different points out in the square, see the place where John Paul II was shot, for example. There's also a number of documents that are there from different sources. So if they want to go deeper, they can read some scholarly books and articles about St. Peter's Basilica.
So is this site more for the pilgrim, or is it even directed towards serious researchers, art historians?
Right. I'm trying to do both, in that the casual pilgrim who has is getting ready to go to St. Peter's or has been there can go to the site and learn a little bit more, go to the next step, and kind of browse around through St. Peter's. But also, I get email daily from serious scholars who are doing articles on St. Peter's and are starting to use the site as a resource. And I want to make it a resource with the best scholarly information for those serious students of St. Peter's as well.
What are some of the unusual things that people visiting your site might come upon?
They'll see very good photographs of a number of areas, things that they're maybe not able to see or that they missed when they went to St. Peter's, detailed photographs of the monuments, but also some of the stories, which are quite interesting about St. Peter's, the stories of the different architects, the different artists, and the different popes, because we have a lot of papal monuments in there, so it's a real tribute to history to learn more about each of these popes and their times and what their tomb represents, to kind of get immersed into Catholic history. It's another way of kind of entering into the beauty of the church, is to learn more about its history.
Do you, Alan, have any particularly favorite or quirky facts about the Basilica that you'd like to share with people?
Well, you know, there are a lot, really. One of the things that I like to do when I'm talking to people about the Basilica or giving tours myself about the Basilica is to start with the obelisk and to start with the question, why is
The obelisk outside in the piazza.
Right, the obelisk outside in the square.
Right.
So my website also covers the area of the square and the colonnades, in addition to the Basilica and the grottos and a little bit about the Scavi as well. But I like to start with, why is it all here? What's, you know, the reason for this? And I point to the obelisk and I say, you know, this obelisk was here before St. Peter's, and talk about, you know, the persecutions, the death of St. Peter, and that perhaps this obelisk was the last thing that St. Peter saw. And then after concluding the tour and we come back out, I point again to the obelisk and I say, you know, this obelisk is very ancient, you know. In fact, it goes back to 1300 years B.C. And we might meditate on who else was alive in 1300 B.C. in Egypt. And I mentioned, well, Moses was, that's the time frame of Moses in Egypt. You know, consider that, well, perhaps Moses even saw this same obelisk. You know, it's a pious thought. And then get them to thinking, well, who else may have been in Egypt? Perhaps the Holy Family was in Egypt, and it's possible even they saw this obelisk. Now, we have no historical information or tradition of that, but it's a pious thought, and it points to a reality, which is the history of the church, and these articles, these stones, which have come down through the ages and are connected with our faith, and it all brings it back to St. Peter's.
Back in the 16th century, Pope Sixtus V had the 1 million pound Egyptian obelisk moved from another site and erected in the center of St. Peter's Square by Domenico Fontana, who especially invented an ingenious mechanism to get the job done.
In the 1580s, it was quite famous. Fontana actually moves that obelisk from its original location on the side of the basilica to out there in the square. And you can still see a place by the entrance to the Scavi, which is the underground excavations where the obelisk originally set. But originally, that obelisk goes back to the Emperor Caligula, who brought it over in about the year 37 to form the center of his circus, the Circus of Caligula, which then became known as the Circus of Nero. And so it goes back to those times when it was brought over in a huge ship, evidently, the largest built to that time, when they brought it over from Egypt. So it's got quite a history of its own.
And just to erect that obelisk there in St. Peter's Square must have required incredible technology, which would have been new for the time as well.
Well, yes, absolutely. There's actually a book just written on that. And Domenico Fontana became quite famous in his time for erecting the obelisk. And it was Sixtus V that had him erect four other obelisks around different sites, and they say that as many as 900 men and 1,000 horses were used out in St. Peter's Square to erect the obelisk. Evidently, 6 months in the planning and 6 months in the actual moving of the obelisk.
Oh my. I seem to recall that around the obelisk there are plaques embedded in the pavement with the various winds, I think, the southern, the western,
right,
the eastern, and northern winds. Is that right? And do you know the history of that?
Well, there's actually quite a few of those marking the different compass points, and they're marked as winds all around the obelisk. The obelisk itself in the 1800s was used as the gnomon of a sundial. So where the shadow of the obelisk hits tells you the solstice markers. And they're in the pavement as well. So there's a lot there just around the obelisk itself. You can see Sixtus symbol there with the lions at the base of the obelisk. We have these markers for the winds, markers for the sundial. There's a lot of history, you know, just right there in the square around the obelisk. And then, of course, the points where all the colonnades line up, you know, this illusion where on each side, the center of the colonnades, Bernini's colonnades, where all the ones in the four colonnades all line up to one columns. So there's a lot just right there before you even enter the basilica.
Any other quirky facts that you don't think about when you're just a tourist or a pilgrim going to visit the basilica? The statues that are lining the facade on the top there of the basilica and around the colonnade, what can you tell me about them?
Well, that's, I think, interesting. People come into the colonnade and they see all these statues, and I don't think that they realize that these are 140 great saints of the church lining this colonnade. It's quite a beautiful setting that Bernini created around 1660. One of the things that I've done recently is to photograph each one of those 140 statues, and I'm trying to make a page for each one of those so they can find out what the name of that saint is, and that saint was a real person. And again, what we're trying to do with the basilica is to bring out the spiritual significance. So there's saints represented all throughout the basilica, out there on the colonnade, the apostles up on the top of the facade, the popes inside, and a series of founder saints inside. One of the interesting things about St. Peter's is that there's always work going on at St. Peter's. You know, we see on the facade the date 1612, from Paul V Borghese, when the facade was finished. And we're talking about 500 years since Julius II laid this cornerstone underneath the St. Veronica Pier. But there's always work going on there. There were monuments being put into St. Peter's up into the early 1900s, St. Pius X. There were statues of founders of religious orders being put into St. Peter's up until the 1950s.
And now, as recently with John Paul II, who also, let's say, jump-started that tradition by putting some statues of new saints in the sides of the basilica.
These are Michelangelo niches, so imagine the honor of having a statue put into a Michelangelo niche on the outside of the basilica. And there's a number of those have been put up recently. Some are only accessible from the Vatican Gardens, but it's ongoing work that's happening.
But how do pilgrims keep from getting caught in a tourist trap and being overwhelmed by all of St. Peter's magnificent art and history? A parting word of advice.
I would just encourage them to take a moment in looking at all this beauty and all this art, to have a spiritual response to St. Peter's and to say a prayer. And there's many good places to do that. They can go into the Blessed Sacrament Chapel, which is just reserved for prayer, and have a quiet moment there and pray before the Blessed Sacrament. Or they can visit the body of John the 23rd, which is now under the St. Jerome altar, and, with that body of that blessed Pope, say a prayer at that point. Many people also love to go before the Pietà and just look at the beauty of the Pietà and have a quiet moment, say a prayer there. So I think I would encourage people to do that, have a spiritual response to St. Peter's.
Alan Howard, editor of the website stpetersbasilica.org. That's all one word without punctuation. It's stpetersbasilica.org. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.